Discussions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. Your host is Bonnie Bright.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Discussions in Depth Psychology, which is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. I'm your host, Bonnie Bright, and I'm also an alumna of Pacifica, and I am conducting this series of interviews in order to help us all get to know a little bit better some of the people that are contributing very deeply to the field of depth psychology, as well as to help extend depth psychology in the world. And I'm here today with Pat Katsky, who is a core faculty member at Pacifica and is offering an upcoming certificate program in depth psychology and appreciative nature practices with Craig Chalquist, and that starts on April 15th of this year, 2016. Pat, thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, thank you, Bonnie.
Well, it's great to have you here, and I'm really excited to talk about this topic, which is something that's very near and dear to my own heart. A lot of my own studies at Pacifica were done in the realm of particularly nature and a Jungian take on our relationship to nature. And, of course, that it was a common thread that goes through many of his writings. Let me just read your bio so that everybody knows a little bit more about your background, and then we'll jump in and talk about the topic in some more detail. Pat Katsky, PhD, has been a core faculty member at Pacifica for over 15 years, teaching and mentoring students in many of Pacifica's programs. She's currently serving as vice provost and formerly was chair of the depth psychotherapy program. She was certified as a Jungian analyst 20 years ago and has been a psychotherapist for over 30 years. Her research interests include the process of becoming a psychotherapist, the world of dreams, and the religious function of the psyche. She has published and lectured on these topics in the United States and abroad. Pat was formerly the president of the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles and serves regularly on the reviewing and certifying boards of the San Francisco and Los Angeles Jung Institutes. She co-founded a nonprofit counseling center in Los Angeles, Counseling West, which serves individuals, couples, and families seeking a depth psychotherapeutic approach in charting a path in their lives. And she continues to participate in this organization as a member of the board of directors. So, Pat, wow, again, I mean, 30 years of experience and history as a psychotherapist, and as I mentioned before, I know that a lot of Jung's work and a lot of the practice of psychotherapy, particularly more and more, I think, these days, is really focused on what our relationship is, not only to ourselves, but also to each other and, of course, our relationship to the world around us, and a big part of that is our relationship to nature. I wondered if we could start by having you talk a little bit about your own connection to the natural world. How did you end up co-teaching a course that is so really specifically focused on earth issues?
that's a big question, Bonnie. but it actually began with the lucky fact that in my childhood, we lived very close to open stretches of land near hills, and we were pretty much able to just roam free as kids, hiking and playing games out in the natural world. So few children in our culture today have that kind of access. And as I became an adult, I have always found that some of the most psychologically healing experiences for me happen in the natural world. So I hike, I backpack, the synchronicities, the teachings that happen in natural settings are just very precious to me.
That's so beautiful, and we have that in common. I had also the benefit of growing up out in the, I guess, what they called the country at the time. I don't know if that term is still used, but I grew up on a farm and had that capacity to wander a lot. And some of my early memories, too, are just going out completely by myself and even falling asleep on the ground and just waking up with a sense of that earth below me and the sun shining on me. And I have such a tremendous recollection of this sense of just peace and connectedness and even oneness, although I probably wouldn't have described it as such at the time. Can you talk a little bit about the psychic bond that exists between humans and the earth and the creatures and the plants and even the cosmos as a whole? I think in common current society, we have really lost that sense of connectedness. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about the bond that is inherent.
Well, if you think about our, I guess, probably million-year history as something beginning to approach the humans that we are today, up until very recent times, man lived in nature. and needed nature and needed to understand and relate and experience nature, but I think in another way did not feel separate from nature. And I feel that with the coming of the Industrial Revolution, the growth of modern society, that kind of natural existence in nature, it becomes literally something that people do on vacations. You go to a national park maybe for 2 weeks on a vacation, then you go back to a job or a setting where nature is very distant for you. I was listening yesterday to a wonderful interview on NPR. Krista Tippett interviewed a wonderful woman, Robin Wall Kimmerer, who has a beautiful book called Braiding Sweetgrass. She is a member of the Potawatomi Nation. And in their language, the only thing that is described with the pronoun it is something actually made by humans. Every other being, every other animal, rocks, water, the natural world are spoken of the way we would speak of other humans. It felt like such a beautiful image of what we have lost. She began life as a child growing up very much in nature and then became a botanist. And she spoke movingly about how difficult it was for her to marry her experience of the natural world that was so deeply lived and felt with the need to begin to see plants more in the way that her scientific training was encouraging her to see them.
That's beautiful, and I am familiar with her book as well, and I'm definitely going to go look up that interview now that you mention it. One thing that I remember that she talks about is how when you know that you love the earth, that it changes you, and it really activates you, and it motivates you, and inspires you to work toward protecting it and celebrating it in the ways that I know that earth-based peoples are known for. Mm-hmm. But she also says that when you feel that the earth loves you in return, that then the whole relationship begins to transform, and that's when it goes from being sort of a, I think the way she put it was a one-way street into that more of a sacred bond.
That's such a beautiful way of putting it, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So I highly recommend that book, and I think it's lovely that she has put it out there. I wonder if you can say something a bit about just switching gears here. Because of your background as a psychotherapist, and particularly your focus on depth ecology and union analysis, how do our dreams shed light on our connection to the planet? Because that is something that is increasingly being talked about, particularly in the depth world, and maybe it has for a long time.
That's a wonderful topic. You know, dreams are the deepest part of us speaking to us and sharing wisdom, sharing perspectives. And when a dream is particularly strong, Jung used the word numinous to describe certain kinds of dreams in which you feel in the presence of something larger than yourself, when you feel awe, you feel a sense of mystery. And I have seen so many really important dreams like this, life-changing dreams that people have had that have involved the natural world. Sometimes it's a visit from a particular animal, and sometimes that animal becomes almost like an inner totem figure. Sometimes I have seen some extraordinary images, and I have permission, by the way, to share any dream image that I share. I can remember one man who, just at the point in his work where he was really beginning to deepen into who he was and what he was becoming, he had a dream where he had the experience he was just standing in nature on some ground, and he felt a lot of shaking, and he thought, oh my goodness, it's an earthquake. But then he became aware of the fact that what he was standing on was not just the earth. It was a giant living animal that was shaking itself awake. So
wow.
There are images like that. I've had people have images that have to do with the stars, of stars moving unnaturally, or of the sun and the moon being in a different relationship with each other. And as you can imagine, when people have these kinds of images, they are lifelong precious experiences. So those are just some of the ways in which I've seen the importance of images from the natural world as they show up in particular dreams.
Well, I love that, and I'm so grateful that you're sharing stories, because having these kinds of concrete images is really helpful to begin to understand, particularly how other people are sort of perceiving this. And I'm especially interested, as I mentioned, in what's happening on the planet, and I think many of us are, particularly in the space of depth psychology, and wondering how we can instigate some kind of change so that there's more, not only awareness amongst the collective and what we're doing to the planet, basically, but also that whole idea of coming into some relationship with it. Mm-hmm. So when I hear you describing these dreams that people have had, it, of course, makes me think of some of my own dreams that have been very poignant or very obviously connected to nature, with maybe the dream animals or totems that have emerged from it. Mm-hmm. How do you recommend typically that people who are really craving this connection and knowing the value and importance of reconnecting with the earth and nature and this kind of emergent quality that is always around us, how do you recommend that people work with it? Because it's one thing to have a dream and to experience those images, but I think it's another thing to actually begin to work with it in a way that allows us to come into that deeper relationship and understand what's happening there.
Well, one of the beauties about our relationship with nature is it exists both inside of us and outside of us. And I think for some people, it's absolutely essential. They're coming into greater sense of connection with the earth really requires them to do things in the outer world. It may mean particular kinds of things, like creating a garden. It may be visiting particular kinds of natural settings that draw one. But it could also be just needing to live someplace other than the middle of a city. So I think there's many different ways, and for each person, some of the ways indicate themselves to you. I can think of a woman who started having a series. She actually had an incredible dream of a particular unusual kind of horse. And she had for so long been wanting to go back, and she had ridden when she was younger. And she was looking for a horse to buy, and she actually found a horse that had the coloring that the horse had in her dream. And she knew she had to buy it, and she had to devote herself to taking back up this connection with the world of horses and riding that had been precious to her, but that she'd put aside as she was, you know, working her way in the working world and so on.
So I think what I'm hearing is that something she did in the outer world actually was able to almost like make that more tangible and therefore give her a touchstone that she could be with and experience on a daily basis. And I really like what you said about relationship being both the inner and the outer. It makes me think of this book that I've had on my shelf for many years, actually. It's called The Dream Seekers, and the author is Irwin, and he's focused on some of the Native American practices of dreaming. And he talks about how in many of the Native American cultures, actually, that when people had dreams, and of course they were mostly dreaming cultures, they often would, and I hate to generalize, I'm sure different people had different practices, but one of the practices that he talks about is how they would gather in the morning to do dream work before, you know, they started their day. That was kind of the most important ceremonial sort of piece of things, to see what it meant for the tribe that was coming out of people's dreams. But another of the practices that he mentions is that idea of making something tangible that's coming from a dream, doing something, either creating a craft or an image of it or a drawing. I'm sure they were using nature elements, and to bring it into some kind of form so that the person that had the dream would always have that with them. And even if it was destroyed, it could actually be recreated at any point in time, and then the dreamer would still have access to that kind of dream. Are you familiar with any kind of practices like that, and or is that something that you think would be important?
Yes, actually, we're going to be incorporating two of the things you talked about just now in the certificate program. There's a process called community dreaming, and it's similar to what you were describing. It takes place in the beginning of the day. Everyone sits close enough so that they can hear each other very clearly. It's best done with your eyes shut, although that's not necessary. And people share a dream image. Now, there's absolutely no interpretation. There's no intellectual response. that's presented during the time when the dream is shared. The only response is to either share another dream image or possibly share an image that's arising for you in the moment, or perhaps echo some of the words that the dreamer said. And there is a scribe who takes down the conversation. After maybe 20 minutes or so, we stop, and the scribe reads back the images, and then we take a break. And then we come back and have a brief discussion of how the experience felt and what people felt about it. And what's really interesting about this approach is that so often for the rest of the day, there's just experience after experience that comes up that relates to some of the images that were talked about in the morning. So we will be doing that on the second morning of every session. And then another thing we will be doing is having people work with a dream image. This will be probably in the third session, and provide them with a whole range of art supplies. And when I've done this before on the Pacifica campus, the campus itself is so vibrant and full of beautiful natural materials that a lot of times people will end up going outside and making something, as you described, from natural pieces of the landscape that they bring back and use. But we also have various kinds of paints and collage materials and so on, so that people can really take their dream image to the next level.
I love that. I love the idea that you will be introducing some of those exact practices back into our culture. And again, I know that a lot of people are probably doing some of those practices already, but it's really, I think, heartening on some level when we see what's happening around us, and it can be sometimes very overwhelming to understand the dire straits that we're in, and mm-hmm. to be able to see that these kinds of practices can bring us back into some kind of connection that will, at least if not change the planet altogether, can help some of us who are willing to engage in these practices to be more centered as we go through this mm-hmm. process of mm-hmm. decline, right, that we mm-hmm. seem to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are there other aspects of the, well, I guess it's easy because we're talking about the certificate program, but are there other aspects or approaches of that particular program that you're looking forward to sharing together as a group? I know that in the description, there's a lot of mention of psychology of place, of neurobiology, and our understanding mm-hmm. how that's coming into it, of Eastern spirituality. And I know that you're co-teaching that with Craig Chalkwith, who I also know quite well, and is probably introducing some of those elements. But I'm curious about what you're looking forward to the most.
Well, one of the things personally, and this is very personally, that I'm really looking forward to is listening to other speakers, because, first of all, I'm really excited to be working with Craig, who I just have such great respect for and so much appreciation of his work. It's going to be very, very exciting to hear him. I'm excited. Marshall Krutowski is our landscaper at Pacifica. We have a biodynamic, what you might call an edible landscape at Pacifica, an organic garden out of which a lot of the food for our meals comes from our organic garden. And Marshall is an incredible presenter of information about his world. He actually has, I believe, a PhD in botany, so he's very knowledgeable. But mostly he's like the archetype of the green man. I don't know if you've met Marshall, but he's probably in his 60s, and he's just lived so deeply in the natural world that it just sort of infuses his whole being. And I'm really interested. Steve Eisenstadt is going to do a presentation on dream tending, and it's always wonderful to hear Steve. Joe Cambray will be talking about complex adaptive systems. One of the things that we're discovering is that our sort of scientism has led us to see so many things as actually being separate that are really, in fact, deeply interconnected, and that certain kinds of systems can reach a level in which new, more complicated order arises as the system grows and develops, which is really a very radical idea. So Joe's going to talk about that material and also bring us up to date. I think there's so much going on in our understanding of how the mind works and what the neurological basis of our experience is. And he's going to go into what is going on for us internally in the way our mind works when we're in natural settings. how can we measure that? How can we see what that's really doing to the way our brain works? And we are having a wonderful opportunity. Joe Bobro, who is a clinical psychologist as well as a Zen Roshi, is going to talk about Buddhism in the natural world. And that's going to be very interesting because there's, the Buddhist perspective is so much about interdependence, and they're beautiful images and ways of understanding the natural world and our relationship to it that reside in the Buddhist tradition. We also will be having Linda Bazell, and she and Craig are going to present on eco-resilience. How can we find a path forward with heart, given the difficult times that we're in and the need that we have to find a way to forge a different relationship to the natural world than we currently have as a species?
Oh, it sounds so rich. There's so much going on there. I hardly know where to start to kind of pick up on, on some of those threads. But the whole idea of complexity and systems theory and the idea that, of course, we're all connected and it's impossible not to, for one thing that we're doing seemingly over here in our corner is not going to be affecting what's happening over on the planet over there. And, of course, that goes for everything from whether or not we purchase an item that was made from wood mm-hmm. that comes from a tree that was in a forest that probably should have been protected somewhere, and it may be not sustainable. And, of course, all the way down to each of us doing our own individual work, whether in therapy or otherwise, just to heal ourselves and become more whole and become more conscious about what our place in the world is around us. Mm-hmm. Do you think that part of your own journey in becoming a therapist and offering basically a container for people to do that kind of work was based on, in any way, maybe our relationship with nature and even what you saw happening on the planet 20 or 30 years ago when you were first entering the field?
Well, it's an interesting relationship. I once read somewhere that the favorite vacation of therapists is backpacking. I don't know what study it was. It was many years ago. And I had to really laugh because what I found was that for myself personally, after really immersing myself so deeply in the psychic world of so many people, there was something replenishing in a way that I can't even put words to from being in remote natural settings. I happen to be a high mountain person. Everything above 10,000 feet is my idea of bliss. So I would head off with a couple of friends or some family members, and we would just get into these very meditative places of deep silence and let nature speak to us, let the natural world give us the gifts that were there for us and then enriched us and made us have the capacity to go back and go on giving in other ways to other people. So it was this very interrelated necessity for me to spend time in the natural world. And in fact, I currently am a docent in a nearby nature preserve owned by UCSB. And what we do there is we offer trips into nature for school children, for the general public. And for many years, I really enjoyed being a part of that system, helping people take that step into the natural world that may not be familiar to them, and then watching what happens to them when they do that.
Mm. Oh, that's beautiful. It's making me think of a speaker that I saw a couple of years ago at a big women's conference, and it was an Indian woman who was talking about how kids, and we kind of started in this place, Pat, it's kind of interesting, it's coming back around for me at least, but she was mentioning how in some of the inner slums, particularly the very large, very poor areas in India, that some of the kids there have never even seen a tree except as a picture in a book. Mm-hmm. And that just broke my heart when I thought about that. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I complain a lot having grown up on a farm because there were certain aspects of that that were difficult probably compared to kids that were living in the city, quote unquote. But the idea that we have access to those things still fairly easily, at least in many parts of our country, and the fact that you're able to bring people into that kind of contact is really meaningful for me. And I think that you're bringing up a really important aspect that we haven't talked about that I'd love to hear your thoughts about, and that is the whole idea of awe and wonder and what kind of a role that plays. Have we lost that in our society? Do we have the capacity for that still? What role does that play for us, and particularly moving us forward into the future?
Well, Jung said that the main focus of his work was not on pathologies, but on the approach to numinous experiences, these experiences of awe, of being in the presence of something sacred. And he felt that that in itself was the chief direction that he tried to get people to move in working with him. And he felt that having these experiences themselves was what healed people. And I think that's so true, because when you have an experience like that, it centers you. It's something you can't ignore, you can't turn away from. And it's like a puzzle. Somebody's given you a giant puzzle, and you have to puzzle over it for years to maybe discover the full range of its meaning. I know I've had dreams that I understood one way for maybe 10 or 15 years, and then later discovered a whole other way of looking at them. So I think the sense that you're engaged in a dialogue with a kind of an inner wisdom that will speak with you and give you what you need, give you images, give you dreams, give you synchronicities to help you to continue the path of your own individuation. That's how I see the role of awe, is really as a critical, one of the guideposts. Those kinds of experiences are like guideposts along the path of one's individuation.
Oh, I love that. And that brings to mind one of my favorite quotes from Jung. And that's the question that he asked me. He says, are we related to something infinite or not?
Mm-hmm.
And that is the telling question. That should be the telling question of our lives. Because it begins to put us into context, doesn't it, around something that is larger than our everyday problems and challenges.
Mm-hmm. You know, another quote of his that I have been thinking about a lot as we've been talking is in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, where he says that he thinks the individual human life is like the growth that comes out of a rhizome. And for people who don't know what rhizomes are, they're these very extraordinary class of plants where the roots kind of go out sideways, and you don't know underneath the surface that this is happening, but suddenly there's a new plant that emerges. It looks like it's a totally separate plant, but it's not. It's living off this much larger rhizome. Raspberries are like that. So you plant a raspberry garden, and pretty soon you have bushes popping up all over the place because the rhizome is just spreading. And to think of ourselves as not really fully separate beings, but rather as feeding off of this deep, nourishing rhizome that surrounds us. I have just spent a lot of time dwelling on that image and appreciating that he chose to speak of us that way.
That is such a beautiful image, and actually is, a wonderful place for us to leave this off. Our time has gone so fast, Pat, but it's been really such a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, Bonnie, it's been wonderful to speak with you, too.
Well, thank you so much. And just a reminder for everybody that Pat is co-teaching a certificate program that starts on April 15th, 2016, alongside Craig Chalquist. And as you mentioned, Pat, there are also a number of other speakers who will be brought into that. And that program is a certificate in depth psychology and appreciative nature practices. And you can find out more information about that at pacifica.edu, and just click on the public programs there and you'll find that. Pat, thank you again so much. I really appreciate you being with me today.
Happy to do it, Bonnie. Take care.
You've been listening to Discussions in Depth Psychology, powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute with host Bonnie Bright.